The following program is brought to you by Winthrop University Hospital. It's the weekend. Be good to yourself. It's Katz's Corner with Dr. Aaron Katz and Dr. Philippa Cheatham, where you can get simple, straightforward answers to your questions about health, from diet and supplements to lifestyle changes. To reach Dr. Katz and Dr. Cheatham, call 800-848-WABC. Now, live on 77 WABC, the chairman of urology at Winthrop University Hospital in New York, with co-host Philippa Cheatham, attending in urology at Winthrop University Hospital, here is Dr. Aaron Katz.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome again to another live round of Katz's Corner here on WABC Radio in New York. I'm your host, Dr. Aaron Katz, and we're live at 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Good morning, everyone. We have a wonderful show, a terrific guest, outstanding today. Good morning, Philippa. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited about today's guest.
Yeah, we really have a great show, and there has been obviously so much interest in the entire integrative world, and today we are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Ronald Hoffman, a longtime friend, a guest on the show, and extremely influential in the field of integrative and holistic medicine. He is the medical director of the Hoffman Center here in New York City. And also, Philippa, as you know, a host of his own radio show here in New York called Intelligent Medicine. That's on WOR on Saturdays from 1 to 2. You can find out more information about himself and about his center at drhoffman.com.
I do know about Ron's show. In fact, we've both been on the show.
We have.
It's a fantastic show. And actually, Ron and Laurie, who sat with us in the studio, have educated me on many aspects of integrative medicine. So I think
Same
it's going to be superb.
So same here.
For those tuning in, this is a great show and a perfect opportunity to ask questions about all sorts of aspects of integrative, holistic urology and other medical issues.
Yes. And, you know, we were going to focus today. And good morning, Ron. How are you?
Good morning. And, you know, I just want to say that, you know, thank you very much for all those accolades. And you guys have been guests on my program, Intelligent Medicine, great guests. And we also go way back, you and I,
yes,
Dr.
We do.
Katz, because we know each other. Well, I don't even say how long, but we go back to the time of Dr. Atkins.
Yes.
When I used to refer patients to you for your special procedures, innovative procedures that you performed at the Atkins Center. And I don't even want to say when that was.
Come on, Ron. Spill some gossip.
That'll date us.
No,
that'll date us.
I'm sure you've got some great stories to tell from
Indeed.
Aaron's dim and distant past.
Well, I wanted to focus today on two things. Obviously, the main parts about integrative medicine, which is dietary supplements and the role of diet. So let's get right to it, Ron. A lot of people are taking supplements out there as well as multivitamins. And one of the first things that Philip and I were discussing was, you know, is multivitamin, is it good enough to take just a multivitamin, or should we be taking specific components? Specifically, let's just talk about maybe the vitamin Bs, for example, you know, B6, B12, B2. They have small amounts, even vitamin D, small amounts in the multivitamin. Should we be just forgetting the multivitamin and maybe just taking those individual components?
Well, you know, I think multivitamins may be beneficial for people who are on very poor diets, you know, just sort of an insurance policy. They may be missing a key element like zinc or selenium or, you know, one crucial B vitamin. But for people who eat well and who supplement, then it becomes more a matter of what you just said, which is to target to a specific medical condition or a predisposition, like say genetically someone has a likelihood of prostate cancer or breast cancer, heart disease, then we use targeted nutrition using specific nutrients that are, we call them nutraceuticals, because they are not just to make sure you don't have a deficiency, but they can actually help you avert or treat even disease.
I think we also need to make the point, don't we, Ron, that multivitamins and any supplement is not a substitute for a healthy diet. I mean, just because somebody's on a poor diet and they may be deficient, you can't just carry on eating McDonald's and hope that taking a multivitamin is going to get you out of jail.
But this is actually one of the shibboleths, the criticisms of vitamin supplementations. The people who take vitamins, they don't take good care of themselves because they think, well, the vitamins are going to help me. And that really is not the case. It's more the people who are affirmative about their health that are taking supplements. And generally, they're careful about diet and exercise and other aspects of their lifestyle.
Sure. The big vitamin these days is vitamin D, which is also considered to be a hormone-like action. We're seeing a lot of information about vitamin D and its relationship to cancer. Do you believe that, Ron? Do you think that their low levels of vitamin D has been associated with cancer? And what do you recommend in terms of vitamin D supplementation?
Well, I've been an early proponent of vitamin D supplementation. In fact, I remember even testing people back in the early 90s for their vitamin D levels when it wasn't even in vogue. And now we're coming to recognize that it's so important, you know, not just for cancer prevention, but for heart disease prevention, for autoimmune disease, for so many, even mental and mood conditions. So it's very important. I supplement high. I generally supplement, on the average, perhaps 2,000 international units for virtually everyone. It's safe. But some patients, we use targeted supplementation of 5, 10,000 or more. You know, if they have multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis, we'll use high doses.
Any risk of that? Any risk of going high dose?
There can be a risk, but I have to say, you know, knock wood here. You know, when you monitor levels, which we do quite frequently, people who are on high doses, just like you monitor a medication, there's very little danger or problems.
Quick question: patients are coming in with blood results from their annual physical, and there's the vitamin D2 and the vitamin D3. And when patients buy vitamin supplements over the counter, it's the D3 that you're actually taking. Can you just talk a little bit about D2 versus D3? Which one do you look at and which one do you think is more important?
Well, unfortunately, the medical prescription for vitamin D is vitamin D2, which is ergocalciferol, which is about 50% less effective than vitamin D3. It's not bad, it's just less bioactive and bioavailable. So the vitamin D3, which is mostly what you get in health food stores, that's the better kind, and that's the one you want to shoot for.
And lots of patients are taking one dose a week,
right,
a large
the 50,000.
Dose a week. Do you think one dose a week, a large dose, is better than taking a smaller amount daily?
I think it's a quick way to ramp up to higher levels if you need. Say you have a very low level of vitamin D and you want to go higher, but unfortunately the prescription type that doctors prescribe is vitamin D2. And we do prescribe the 50,000 once a week, but we use the vitamin D3, which we think is more effective.
I wonder, Ron, do you think that this vitamin D issue has always been there, or is it just that we're now able to measure it? I mean, is it that we've changed our diets and we're going less dairy? Is it the sunshine effect and we're using more sunscreen? Are we staying indoors more factor?
It's a disease of civilization, because we used to be farmers and, you know, agriculturalists, and we didn't have tall buildings and skyscrapers, and we didn't stay inside. And, you know, our skin is adapted to absorbing the ultraviolet light to convert provitamin D into active, metabolically working vitamin D. So it's a disease of modern civilization.
A patient asked me on Friday for a prescription for a three-week holiday in Barbados to raise their vitamin D levels. We're not quite at that yet.
Let's switch to vitamin C. And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Ron Hoffman. He's the medical director of the Hoffman Center here in New York, and really a world expert on, obviously, if you're tuning in and you're hearing all of this information, a world expert on integrative and holistic medicine. Ron, vitamin C, you know, Linus Pauling, back many years ago, the Nobel Prize laureate for his work, and now we're getting into the cold and flu season. What is the latest research telling us about vitamin C and preventing colds?
There's a modest protective effect.
Okay.
And I think one expert said it this way, that Linus Pauling was right. He was just off by one letter in terms of cold and flu prevention, because it's vitamin D that probably offers more protection, especially against flus.
Really? Okay.
And vitamin C, you know, somewhat protective, but the latest research that's very exciting is intravenous vitamin C, very high-dose vitamin C. And some people say, well, okay, I can't afford to go for IVs. My doctor won't do that, so I'll just take a lot by mouth. It doesn't do the same thing. And that's why some of the research that Linus Pauling did was debunked. It showed that vitamin C didn't really cure or prevent cancer. Well, that's because it was given orally. Intravenous vitamin C has powerful actions against cancer.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The vitamin C data, isn't it best to take vitamin C preventatively to prevent coughs and colds. If you're already sniffling and coughing, you've missed the boat.
It will shorten the duration of colds. It will attenuate the severity of viral infections. But it's not an ultimate bulwark against all misfortune.
While we're on the subject of coughs and colds, what do you think about echinacea as a treatment for...
I think echinacea has, you know, some effectiveness. You know, there are other things that can be used also that we like to use. We like to use something called pelargonium, which is it's a sort of a more exotic herb that has antiviral capabilities. So, you know, a variety of things.
Is that, can you buy that from a health food shop?
Yeah, the let's see, the product is called ViraClear. ViraClear is the product that I like to use.
All right, and being an integrative physician, I'm sure you hear, obviously, you're advising patients about the flu shot. So let's just take, forget about the immune compromised or the elderly patient, but the average risk guy or woman, what are your thoughts? I got to put you on the spot here, Ron.
No, that's funny, because actually that was the lead story on my radio program yesterday. I talked about an article that was in the British Medical Journal, which was a critique of the campaign to get everybody vaccinated with the flu shot, all that, you know, brouhaha, but, you know, you must get the flu shots, you know. There's a guy named Peter Doshi, who's a PhD epidemiologist, who wrote this article in the British Medical Journal that states that the flu shot is oversold, that its efficacy is, you know, it's somewhat effective, but from year to year that may vary. And for the very people that's supposed to protect, the immunosuppressed, the elderly, it's not that effective. And plus, there are some side effects. You know, rarely people can get sick from the flu shot. There's mercury in the shot. So, you know, it's oversold.
What do you think about supplements to enhance the immune system? You know, Philip and I have discussed a lot about AHCC.
Yeah. And one of my favorites, by the way.
So we love AHCC, but are there other supplements, or what about the diet? Can people add things or eliminate things in their diet to boost their immune system this time of year?
Well, firstly, let's talk lifestyle. Okay, so you know, from the standpoint of lifestyle, sleep deprivation is a huge problem, especially around holidays. You wonder why everybody gets sick. Well, everybody's so busy. They're Christmas shopping. They're working to make the money to buy the presents and the social gatherings and yada, yada. And so people get sick. And then there's, you know, a lack of exercise. Sedentary people get more sick. But also people over-exercise. They really, you know, push. People who do the marathon, about 40% of people come down with an upper respiratory infection after the marathon. So it's too much. So you want to find the sweet zone, you know, between overexertion and sedentary lifestyle.
Well, we're talking about the flu season, Ron. There was some data out last year about AHCC improving your response to the flu shot. So if you take the flu shot, they showed that there was a higher eradication. I think it was of influenza A.
Yep.
But that's certainly something that I think is great for patients to take. There's active hexose correlated compounds, which has certainly been associated with eradication of other viruses.
Right.
In fact, there was new data out
HPV.
That's
HPV.
Right, last week.
Very exciting.
Very exciting. In fact, the media picked it up internationally, and they showed that this was one of the first treatments ever to actually eradicate the virus that causes cervical cancer. And also, we know in urology that there's an association with HPV with penile cancer. I think this is so exciting.
We had a call yesterday from someone who had genital warts, and he said, "What can I do for genital?" You know, they just put this chemical on
Podophyllin,
right, on the lesions. And I said, well, you know, consider AHCC, because the chemical will eradicate it, but you want to make sure that your own immune system fights it off, because viruses tend to recur. So, yeah, that's a great thing.
Are there any other foods, Ron, this time of year to boost the immune system that people can go out and buy?
Well, first, you know, let's look at some things that are immunosuppressive. I really think that excess sugar and excess refined carbohydrates are very immunosuppressive.
Okay.
We know that. I mean, diabetics with high blood sugar, they get all kinds of infections, poor wound healing. So that's a downer on immunity. And then, you know, you want to eat, you know, the colors of the rainbow. You want to eat a technicolor diet, because all the colors in fresh fruits and vegetables are the signature for these natural polyphenol compounds that have so many benefits and do support the immune system.
Such as what?
Well, such as pomegranate. I make sure that I always have a serving of berries every day, you know, whether it's raspberries, blueberries, boysenberries. These are potent. They're potent compounds in there. And then the spices, you know, we have, curcumin and things like that that are important things that can be
helpful. And when you talk about refined sugars being immunosuppressive, just tell us a little bit about, for people who are listening, what you mean by refined sugars. What are the foods that people should avoid that are considered to be high in refined sugars?
Well, we tend to think, refined sugar is like white sugar, but, also soda, that's the major vehicle by which Americans get sugar, high fructose corn syrup. But then it's ubiquitous. It's in ketchup. It's in salad dressing. White bread, well, basically it breaks down to sugar very readily in the body. So I recommend to most of my patients a lower carb diet, which is kind of in contradistinction to our dietary guidelines, which I think are terribly misguided,
And of course, the whole controversy about gluten. Everyone wants to take gluten-free this, gluten-free that. I mean, that is a big. I wonder if this is a big fad now. That's just going to fade out or not.
It is, and it's sort of like a California thing. It's like make mine gluten-free. Gluten-free is the new fat-free. It's a new trendy thing.
Right.
But there really is something to it because so many of my patients have adverse responses to gluten. It really suppresses the immune system for some. Some people are allergic, overall, gluten is delivered in a form that's relatively refined, so getting that out of the diet can be a real boost to not just your immunity, but mental acuity, helps you maintain optimal weight.
It's amazing, actually, when you talk to patients who eliminate gluten, they talk about so many improvements in symptoms, migraines in particular, bloating, concentration, and people say they just feel a completely different person. But I think years ago it was very difficult to be on a gluten-free diet, but certainly in Manhattan, I'm not sure about elsewhere, but it's actually quite easy to get hold of gluten-free food.
You have to be aware of that. You have to be aware of that because some of these gluten-free things, they're just laden with calories, and they're they're ersatz forms of cookies and donuts and cronuts and things like that, which are not necessarily good for you. So you got to, I think people should be a little wary of this plethora of gluten-free products. Maybe they shouldn't be having that much in the way of grains.
You see it on restaurant menus as well, don't you? Gluten-free pasta.
It's trendy. I just interviewed Dr. William Davis, who's the wheat belly guy, and that podcast will be at drhoffman.com next week. It's fascinating because it can be a huge transformation for some people, people with weight problems, metabolic syndrome, lethargy, depression, bloating. I mean, it's a huge paradigm shift.
Ron, just going back to the diet again. So there are a lot of patients that have cancer. Philip and I, obviously, we see a lot of bladder cancer, prostate cancer. But for cancer in general, they want to know what diet that they should take. Do you feel that there is a specific diet for a specific cancer? Like if you have breast cancer, is there a diet that, that is specific for breast cancer or prostate cancer? Or is it just a general type of diet that you should modify when you are been diagnosed with cancer?
I think it gets even more complicated than that because there not only may there be specific diets for certain cancers, but there may be a specific diets for certain phases. So, for example, a diet that's prostate cancer preventive may not be ideal for someone who is undergoing
radiation
or chemotherapy because at that time you. As you know, you actually want the cancer cells to be in a proliferative state, so they're more vulnerable to the chemo and radiation. So it doesn't make sense to tell someone who's getting intensive cancer therapy to starve themselves, because even if it stopped the cancers from growing, that would render them less likely to be treatable.
And this leads into my next thought, which is if you're undergoing chemo and radiation, and I know that you believe in antioxidants, what should patients that are on antioxidants stop these supplements before radiation and chemo? This comes up time and time again, and the standard, conventional oncologist says stop everything.
Well, this is a super tough question. And, theoretically, yes, some of the chemo agents and certainly radiation work by creating free radicals, which damage and kill the cancer cells preferentially over your regular cells. But, if you take this to the extreme, then you say no antioxidants. That would mean that the only thing that a cancer patient could take during treatment would be distilled water, you know, because the very food you eat has these antioxidants. So components. What are you going to do? And, you know, I have to say that my experience is that using antioxidants while patients get this type of therapy usually doesn't interfere with therapy, with the chemo, and in fact renders the patient more resistant to the adverse effects. But you have to be selective. I think there are different supplements that can be used with certain agents and others should not be. It's a real complicated situation, and we have to do more research on what's compatible, what's not compatible.
It's tough as well, because we can give advice to patients about what we know is safe, and we've got a lot of experience about integrative products. But the problem is the patient rocks up for radiation, and they are very clearly told by the radiation nurses and doctors, look, stop all these supplements, because they don't know the difference between which ones are antioxidants and which ones are not.
That's an ignorant attitude, because it's sort of like, look, they say, well, one or another of these supplements may or may not create a problem, so therefore stop taking everything. That doesn't make sense. I think we should be more selective about telling people to take this or that and avoid that or this.
While we're on the subject of cancer, two questions that patients ask me a lot. What are your thoughts about acid alkali diet, and should patients think about changing the balance of acid and alkali? Second question, Ron, is patients are always saying to me, we're always talking about juicing and how good juicing is for you, but patients always ask about the sugar in fruits, and particularly cancer patients. Should we be avoiding sugars from fruits if you have been diagnosed with cancer and you want to take a holistic approach?
Okay, well, first, this acid alkaline thing. I've grappled with this for many, many years, trying to figure out a way that we can actually detect whether a person's acid or alkaline. And every technology I've used has fallen short in terms of properly discerning who's on the acid side or more alkaline side.
And what tests are people typically?
Well, you get blood, urine, saliva. But that, you know, if say your urine is acidic, that may mean that your body is alkaline and you're excreting too much acid.
Right.
You know, that doesn't necessarily
mean.
So it's difficult to discern. You know, who is, I don't think this is such an important paradigm. What turns out to make people more acidic? If you sit around and don't exercise, you become more acidic. If you eat meat, it is somewhat acidic. But many cultures which are Paleolithic cultures that consume a fair amount of animal protein, they're predominantly alkaline in their overall balance, because they eat tons and tons of fruits and vegetables to offset the acidity. You know what's the most acidic thing in the American diet is the sugar and the refined carbohydrates. That's the most acidic thing that we get into us. So look, I mean, I think that paradigm is not that useful. Now to the second question, you know, there's this controversy. Do you want, if you have cancer, should you totally restrict carbohydrates, or should you have plenty of healthy juices that may have natural sugars? And there's a big controversy about that. I think it may depend on the cancer. I think there's some studies that suggest a ketogenic diet where you completely cut off all the sugars and all the carbohydrates may starve the cancer. But does that always work? Not necessarily, because some cancer.
That goes back to the Atkins formula, doesn't it?
Atkins was not, as you know, you worked at Atkins, he was not uniformly successful at curing cancer with that type of diet. You know, so, and then you have other people who treat cancer by having patients juice and have virtually no animal protein. So it may depend on the cancer, may depend on the stage of the cancer, and on the individual.
Ron, do you still believe in the omegas? There's been a lot of controversy, at least in our field, about omegas and, with prostate cancer, that it may lead to more aggressive cancer. But there's so many other health benefits to these omegas, with reducing inflammation, the fish oils, reducing cardiac disease. What do you recommend to your patients when they come into the Hoffman Center?
Well, as you know, this whole controversy about the omega-3s contribute to the risk of prostate cancer, based on a rather weak study done up in Seattle, where they took a blood test, and they found that there was a correlation between high levels of omega-3 and prostate cancer years later. So this was not a study looking at whether people consumed fish or whether people took supplements. Not a very good study. I think omega-3s...
It was very flawed, wasn't it?
Very flawed,
But it caused so much anxiety, didn't it, for patients and their doctors about what to recommend?
Well, correlation isn't causation. You have to do more extensive studies. There's so many benefits to omega-3s, cardiovascular standpoint, anti-diabetes, anti-inflammatory. And most of the models suggest that they prevent cancer.
All right, let's take a phone call. Greg, you're on with Dr. Hoffman on Katz's Corner. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, doctors. I just want to ask quickly about two supplements, DHEA and also as an anti-inflammatory, astaxanthin. What are your opinion on those two supplements? And thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Sure. You know, I'm a big proponent of DHEA. I think DHEA, first of all, what is DHEA? DHEA, dehydroepiandrosterone, is a, it's kind of a unisex androgen. You know, like testosterone is mostly a guy thing. Women have a little, but guys have a ton. Women have about a third or a half as much DHEA as most men. So it has an androgenic effect in both sexes. It declines as you age. It has anti-inflammatory properties. It has anabolic properties to prevent sarcopenia, which is muscle loss. And it has mood-enhancing effects. And I'm for it. But the problem is, you know, I'm sitting with a couple of urologists here. You know, say you have prostate cancer and you're taking DHEA willy-nilly. Could it promote prostate cancer? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, it can raise the PSA level in some of the men.
Yeah. And so, you know, it is the cause of the cancer. It's not the cause of the cancer, but could it stoke the fire of cancer? So you got to be careful when you're taking it.
It was interesting. Greg mentioned astaxanthin, which is the chemical that gives melon and salmon its pink color.
It's artificially added to farmed salmon.
And we know, actually, that has a benefit in prostate cancer prevention. Do you want to say something about astaxanthin?
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's on my radar screen. I'm not the biggest fan of it. I know it's an antioxidant, but it's a little bit artificial to pump people with high levels of astaxanthin. You know, it's a carotenoid. So I think using mixed carotenoids, using lots of fruits and vegetables to get that effect.
Ron, when someone comes into your center, and let's say they're 55, 60 years old, average risk male or woman, and they just want to optimize their health, what blood tests do you recommend besides the standard, you know, cholesterol? And I'm sorry, we don't have. I wanted to talk about the whole cholesterol issue. We just have a few minutes left, but just give us an idea of what blood tests people should get out there that would be helpful to them.
The biggest bang for your buck is with a glucose tolerance test with insulin, because that picks up what is the major cause of death and disease in this country, which is metabolic syndrome. So some people might have a normal blood sugar, even a normal hemoglobin A1C, but if you stimulate them with a sugar challenge and you see high insulin, that's trouble, and you can address it with diet modification.
So that's a test you have to – the doctor
It's a 4 to 5 hour test, and you give a sugar challenge, and you measure blood sugar response, and you measure insulin also. And that's a way you can pick up the potential for metabolic syndrome, which is, you know, fixable, fixable.
The blood test, the HbA1c, is really great, isn't it? Because the glucose levels, if you're going in for a blood test and people think, okay, I'm having a blood test Monday morning, I'm going to eat well on Sunday, the HbA1c is going to catch you out because it's looking at blood sugar levels over the previous 3 months.
It was surprising. Some people who even have a fairly normal number on that may have an abnormal insulin. So the glucose tolerance test is not frequently done, but it's worthwhile doing.
All right, Ron, 30 seconds just on the cholesterol. Someone has a mildly elevated cholesterol. I know I'm pressing you here, but just give us your thoughts on the natural things like the red yeast rice.
Here's what I'm going to say.
The statin.
Is that artificially lowering cholesterol, it may help some people who are at high risk. But it doesn't deal with the problem because you're fixing one aspect of the problem, and your number may look good and may, you know, encourage you to eat whatever you want with impunity. Whether it's red yeast rice, which is natural, people like that, but, you know, it's still an artificial.
But are we
lowering.
Putting too much emphasis on the cholesterol? I mean, if you don't have a big family history, do you really, and your cholesterol's mildly elevated, do you need to be that worried about it?
No, I think there's some people who have high cholesterol.
Hey, Aaron, we must have Ron back to do
Ron
another show just
phenomenal.
On cholesterol
I mean,
alone.
This is
I know my dad's
show.
Listening from the UK about the cholesterol thing. So.
Well, you're listening to Dr. Ron Hoffman, medical director of the Hoffman Center in New York. You can reach him easily at Dr. Hoffman. And that's drhoffman.com. Thank you so much, Ron.
Fantastic show.
Me.
Can't wait to have you back, Ron. Brilliant.
Tune in every Sunday, everyone. This is Dr. Aaron Katz.